Baby, come on, oh, baby, come on, oh, cause I've heard your 100th song. And though I liked the tale of the millionaires that constructed the fine bolts and put the buildings in the air.
Joining me in Victoria, BC, Carrie Mercer of Frog Eyes. Welcome, Carrie.
Thank you very much.
Now, I first stumbled across your songs and your very distinctive style in the band Blue Pine, who had an album on Global Symphonic a couple of years ago. And then there was, pretty soon after that came out, this announcement that there was going to be a name change. Some of the personnel would remain the same, but you would be reinvented as Frog Eyes. Can you explain the distinctions between these two groups and why the change?
I'm just wondering when the announcement came out.
It seemed like a few months after the record was released, there was a little thing on the webpage.
Pretty subtle secret, but what happened was, I guess it's the old, you're, you know, involved in this relationship and you discover that your significant other has this musical talent, and that happened with me. My girlfriend at the time, who's now my blessed wife, showed this, like, I don't know, this wonderful ability to play the drums, and it just happened that we had moved into a house together with this wonderful piano player named Spencer. So, and I felt really uncomfortable about Blue Pine. Just, it was really hard to get people together, and the usual kind of band, you know, I don't know,
logistics difficulties and that sort of thing.
Yeah, it's a real difficulty. So it just sort of seemed so blatant that Blue Pine should end and Frog Eyes should begin. And we had a wonderful first show because I had this Blue Pine show booked at the local bar here, and which is, I guess it was called Thursdays at the time. It's a pretty nice place. So I had this whole night, like, and, you know, I had this new band. We have, like, six songs, so I was freaking out. I didn't know what I was going to do. So I had this play kicking around entitled. Now, you might be familiar with the title of it because it's called The Baboon That Ran the Railroad, which is a Blue Pine song, and it comes from the real world.
The whole story.
Well, yeah, I mean, of course it comes from the real world, but you know what I mean. The play is about a baboon that actually did run a railroad in South Africa for, I think, 30 years without any kind of incident. And I took that story and put on a play in between the Frog Eyes songs because I needed to fill up the night, and for an extra bonus for the horrible people that had to come watch this, we served a party sub. You know what that is? A big long sub.
Yeah. Like, so ridiculous? Like, how long?
It was like, it was as long as probably a bus. Yeah. So
a 20-foot sub.
Yeah. You know, a party. Like, okay. I love this idea of, like, communal edibles, or, you know, drinking out of a huge trough, for example.
Okay.
Bringing people together by, you know, we all have the same thing in our guts, so at least there's that. I guess there's something to that in the wafer, you know, if you follow me.
Mm.
I like to lie a bit, so I told people that it was going to be this wonderful Italian crust with Asiago cheese and artichoke hearts and whatnot. But what we really did was we went to Buns Master and got the worst bread and just cut the ends off it. We went to a farmer's market and got the rotten lettuce and then a big jar of Cheese Whiz. So people were just angry, you know, at these party subs. And my actor, who in the play, he got so drunk, he would pass out while we were playing on stage. And he would wake up. I mean, imagine that, waking up and being like, oh my God, I'm so disoriented. Where am I? And seeing like a host of people and a band playing like 2 feet away from your head. But there was a great moment where someone was just like, this party sub is too gross, and like a football whipped it against the stage. And I watched it slowly slide down and rest on the actor, whose name is Reg. Hopefully he comes up more in this interview, because he's a good guy. And the sub woke him up, and he woke up, and, you know, the delicious smell of the lettuce and the cheese whiz. And he just took a big bite, and then, you know, he was ready to act. It was just a Herculean scene, you know.
Did he also play the baboon?
No. I can't remember who played the baboon, actually. You know, this, you just put someone in a hairy suit. Actually, I do remember my friend Steve. Yeah, because he might, you know, he could be listening to this, and a single tear would roll down his cheek at me not recognizing him. So,
with Frog Eyes.
Yeah.
Did you find that there were many things that you changed musically that you were doing from the first band to Frog Eyes?
Yeah, definitely. Well, the introduction of the piano, right? I mean, just, I don't have a background in music, so I can't really give you the reasons why it would be different, but there's so much more range. And the way that the guitar player in Blue Pine, who was just a wonderful guitar player, and the piano player in Frog Eyes are so different. So traditionally, I've been really lucky to have these wonderful trained musicians where I can bounce my, you know, garbage off of, and then they can sort of, I guess, save it with their ability. So, and then now the same thing. That piano player left, whose name is Spencer, to go to Montreal to study music, which he doesn't do anymore because it's not the thing for him. And this man named Grayson Walker from Montreal had just moved here, so it was a nice trade-off. And I guess, I don't know, Grayson's a neat guy. He used to run a legal theater in Montreal, and I think he had a church. He started this Harvey Christ.
Oh, yeah.
You might know.
I've seen
this.
Grayson perform.
Yeah. You know, he's an arrogant prick, but he's a good guy, too, you know. So I've been really lucky to have these wonderful people that I can throw my ideas at, and they, you know, just eat them up. It's wonderful. So I'd say the differences are in that Frog Eyes is so... The piano is so important, and I think there's a little bit more dynamics too. Okay. You know, at first I had a piano and I was playing a lot of songs by myself on the piano, so there was a real nice dichotomy between these just songs by myself and then the full, you know, the moaning and the thrashing and the gnashing of teeth and whatnot, which is basically what we do now. That part is really won over, and I'm happy with that too.
Mm. Well, Carrie, when did, I mean, you mentioned that you don't have any formal musical training or anything, but when did music first sort of reveal itself as a real presence in your life?
Like anyone who ends up playing music, they're going to say, well, my ears have always been open to music. My dad's, he's a, you know, musician, so I guess that's given me a certain amount of confidence, you know, like this genetic inheritance. As soon as I got a guitar, I was like, I know that I'll be able to play this. And I think that sort of confidence is really important for, you know, people starting out, because anyone can, I think. I guess I was about 17. I don't know. Days are really dying in my memory. they've been erased by insult to the brain.
So what was the first bands that you formed?
Well, Reg and I had these bands with, do you know this band Hot Hot Heat? Does that ring a bell?
Uh-huh.
We used to skateboard with the bass player, and we'd make these horrible, like, kind of skate rock, like Demon Rider kind of bands in the garage, you know, just the way that most young punks start out. And then I joined this band, and here I am, you know.
The style that you have as a singer and a lyricist seems to be, has quite a strong sense of itself. which suggests that, you know, there was probably a bunch of experiments that may have preceded it at some point. And so, like, when did you start thinking about wanting to make your own songs the way that they sort of have revealed themselves now?
When I first started to play the guitar, I hooked up with these guys that were making this kind of music that I never heard. And it was like this, you know, these sort of Fugazi kind of clone bands that were...
Mathy kind of...
Yeah, and like, you know, very emotional. And to like, I don't know, what was it, maybe 8-10 years ago, to a 17-year-old, you know, twit... It sure seemed wonderful. So they had this band called Breakwater, and they were going on this tour, and their main guitarist just dropped out. And I was friends with them, and I was like, well, I'll come. This is really wonderful, because you have to understand, I had planned to either live in a ditch or like somehow meet a rich older woman who would just take care of me. So I had no envisioning of, I am a sort of an idiot. So I just couldn't envision any good coming out of the future. So then all of a sudden these nice guys were like, well, let's go, you know, we'll go for a trip. So, I could go on this tour with them, and I just, you know, I didn't even know how to tune my guitar, and it was a pretty hilarious experience. I mean, the poor audience is all I can say. So that was my introduction to music. I mean, most people are like, you know, like learn whatever, how to play Stevie Ray Vaughan in their bedroom for years and then finally venture out into the spotlight. And I don't know which way is better, but this is the way that my, you know, my journey.
Did you start singing?
At that point, when I was about 18 with this band. But it was more like screaming and bellowing and moaning and doing all of that, you know, getting all my demons out, catharsis for the crowd and whatnot. Yeah. So you know exactly what I'm talking about. But then, I mean, you can only do that for so long, and it gets really tiresome. And so I just stopped playing music, and I decided to try and learn how to paint, because that's another thing that I enjoy doing. So I did that for a couple years. And
did you go to school for that? Or?
I went for a couple months, but it was not for me.
Okay.
Art school is sort of wink, wink, nudge, nudge between the students and the professors for the most part. You know, we won't bother you, and if you don't bother me, and then... You know what I mean.
Yeah.
So, that's maybe an overstatement, but that's been my experience. So then, at some point, I just, you know, I got a guitar again, and I started writing songs, and I had planned to put together this band, like with a stand-up bass, and I had this friend this woman who had a really beautiful singing voice, and I'd planned that to be Blue Pine. But she couldn't do it. She couldn't, the phrasing just wasn't in her, you know.
So you'd written the lyrics as well?
Yeah. Okay. So at some point I was just like, you know, I'm going to sing. And it was so difficult. And it's just been this uphill battle. But as soon as I started singing, I was like, this is wonderful, you know. I felt like there was a live wire being thrust into my back, you know. Just, I know it's sort of a cliched idea of like, wow, I felt so alive, but that's the way it went.
Was the flair and the drama already a part of this new way that you were singing?
Well, I just sort of opened. It's not, I mean, I have to protest against the flair and the drama, because that suggests that there's some kind of like plan, you know. It's just sort of the way it has come out, you know. And I mean, over the last couple of years, I've tried to refine it and work on it or roughen it up, but it's the old, like, this is who I am, and this is the representation of who I am, I guess. So,
were there singers that you admired, that you were inspired by, that you thought?
Oh, definitely, yeah. I really, at the time, like, I went through the sort of like Gastro del Sol, like just acoustic plinking. And then I remember I was drunk once and I heard CCR, you know, for the sort of the first time again. And I was just blown away by their cover of the Screaming Jay song, I Put a Spell on You. You know what I'm... Mm. And when he just howls at the end, just shocked, you know. So that, it's like, I always think about the sort of development of the artist is analogous to the development of a child, you know, where the brain just sort of opens up at certain points, and for some reason, that's when learning occurs, you know. And you can't tell, but at just some point, the brain is really receptive to certain things, and that's why, in some senses, it might be really difficult to talk about the artistic process because it almost seems so arbitrary what hits you and what doesn't, you know. But that was definitely one point where I was just shocked by the sound of this music. And I think having that knowledge, if you went back and listened to Bhupan, you might hear some of that sort of, I don't know, the swampy howling.
Carrie, why do you call the songs image clusters?
Oh, well, that was... I don't mean to call that. But what I mean by that is that quite often people are like, well, your lyrics are not... clearly not. It's not a linear narrative, you know. The man went to the factory and got fired and came home and didn't know what to do, so he stole a car, you know. If you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So... But, on the other hand, it's not like I chomp mushrooms, you know, and just see what comes out. And, you know, it's not... A stream of consciousness is, like, quite often a term that gets my hair up, you know.
I'm surprised that would be leveled at you. It seems your stuff seems so very sort of put together, carefully.
Yeah, well,
you know?
Well, maybe it's just laziness on the interpreter's part, I don't know, but what I mean by image clusters, and I hate that term too, but what I mean is that there is a connection between the lines that are being said, but it's just getting from A to B, it's more edifying for me to cover a lot of ground, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's like the sailboat has to tack, you know, to get from A to B, to go to all these different places. And I know this is sort of spiring into art speak cliche, but it's the way I like to do things is grab all of these kind of images and have some kind of at least subtle connection to them. And with this latest CD, I guess my experience of just all of the little stories that suggest themselves from walking in the woods or, you know, finding a gentle creek or, it's totally well-worn territory, but to me, it's been the most, like, liberating thing that my wife has really turned me on to this kind of thing. It's something we really share, and I guess I just wanted to write stories about, to some degree, things that happen in the forest, you know. And I don't know if that necessarily comes across in every song, but that's all right with me. But that's the sort of general thrust behind things.
Mm. I mean, you mentioned that you do a lot of writing and that you just like to write things.
Yeah, it's very difficult, but I, you know... I like it, yeah.
Well, can you tell me about your interests as a playwright and how that feeds in or out of the music that you do?
Well, it doesn't really have anything to do with the music. It's like, it's so different because with the songs, the sound of the music is primary. And whatever, you know, fragmented narrative that exists within the words is actually secondary. You know, I mean, sometimes songs are written for the actual sounds of the words too, you know,
sure.
Just as much. I mean, we all know about this tradition, right? Mm-hmm. So, but where a playwright is just, I try and write the worst kind of plays, you know. I made a horrible movie called Hobo Camp about a rich philanthropist who tries to liberate these hobos from the darkness of their not knowing about culture, and that ends up with monkeys killing everyone. So it's just I love the idea of these people in the audience being like, oh, an independent film, yes. Oh, by a local musician. Truly, it will be wonderful. And then forcing them to sit through the worst crap possible. It just makes my blood race. I get so excited about it. So they're not very connected. But maybe, I don't know, maybe the way that we play live, maybe that I get some satisfaction. Sometimes I hear people, or as, you know, my friends who, you know, maybe like the band will say, oh yeah, there's these people in the corner who were making gagging sounds and plugging their ears, and my blood races in a similar manner when I hear about that, you know? I mean, I guess it's nice to get a reaction out of people, and I don't think that the way my life has occurred and whatnot, that I'm going to be particularly adept at getting a reaction out of people in a beautiful way, you know. Let's weep at the beauty of his art. So,
do you aim for that? Would that be a wish? No.
Well, I mean, when you make music, right? You want people to hear it, and we're totally surrounded by garbage of sound. You know, I mean, what does music even mean to if you don't have an active relationship with it, if it's just passive, if you just mm-hmm. turn on the radio when you come home? I mean, it's as relevant as the sound of the fridge, I guess, you know? I mean, so what if tones are organized around 440 hertz? I mean, you know what I mean? Like, it's just, it doesn't mean anything. So I don't want to say that I could care less about who hears my music and I want you to hate it, because that's not true. But I can't make a single solid statement about it. You know, there's a dichotomy where I hope you like it, but if you don't like it, I hope you hate it, you know. But then again,
which is kind of a defensive position.
Yeah, it is, yeah. But I mean, look at the state of of our culture, you know? I mean, I think if you really want to go out and try and make something truly exists outside of, like, a mercatorial aim, which I think I'm trying to do, then you automatically are in a defensive position.
Okay.
I think.
There's a... And I don't mean this to be vague in any way, but where do song ideas come from? Are they the sort of things that just fall from the sky into your lap that you just make into a song, or are they issues and ideas that you really carefully work out over a period of time?
The song titles, I guess, partly, you know, come from Zeus. that's what I was thinking when you said come out of the sky, you know. Sometimes I'll be working on a song and I'll look up World's Greatest Concertos, you know, has nothing to do with the World's Greatest Concertos, but it's a song about simultaneously the death of this poor woodcutter who works hard for for his children, and he dies in the woods, and his children have to take up his life, and it's terrible, and they're not suited to do it, and the misery becomes a point of celebration because people hear of this miserable situation, and in a sense they revel about it because of the sadness and the sweetness and the melancholy of it, right? So, and then they in the end they celebrate the situation that of misery. I mean, I don't know why I wrote about that, and I don't know why I constructed that little story, but it just seemed appropriate to me at the time. But while I was writing it, I looked up and I saw this box set of records called The World's Greatest Concertos, and like, what a thing to say. You know, it's hilarious, and it's the same kind of like celebration of like the artist's melancholy and the world's greatest concertos. Like, I just sometimes the ridiculousness of what we do and what we say is just it's almost paralyzing, you know. So in cases like that, sometimes it's just serendipity. I just look up. I'm just ready to name a song.
So I know what she's like. I know what's her, what she's like.
I mean, I get a vague sense from a lot of the songs, even going back to the first Frog Eyes record and stuff like Crow Fire Wedding and The Mayor Laments the Failures of His Many Town Folk, pieces like that, that they're like kind of like fables in a way.
Yeah.
Maybe it's the forest setting. Maybe it's the backwoodsness of it all.
Yeah.
But
well,
does that come from a sort of a love of certain literature?
I do like, I like myth. You know, I love Homer. I love Italo Calvino's Italian Folktales is like one of the most wonderful books I've ever read. And, you know, I almost want to weep. You know, when you, it's the interview situation is sort of interesting because it's so focused, you know, and you ask me certain questions and I really have to think about it. And I really just thought about how much I do love these little stories. And it's, I mean, people do their PhDs on folktales, right?
Yeah.
I mean, we don't really know what it is about them. I mean, you can say, oh, well, they present the archetypal situation, but that doesn't sum it up for me. And it's like, it's just enormously satisfying to like the examples you've just given, to give sort of folktale names to the songs, I guess.
Can you tell me what a Crow Fire Wedding is?
Yeah, I can, actually. I'm glad you asked.
I actually have a book of, like, fable and, like, a nice reference book for fable and myth. There's nothing Crow. Crow, this doesn't exist in there.
But you know the movie Crow?
Uh-uh.
From the 1980s, that decade? It's sort of like one of those movies that came out after the success of Star Wars, I guess.
Okay.
And, you know, they're like, well, fantasy's in, so let's really start pumping these movies out.
Okay.
And my friend John, it's a pretty funny movie about a cyclops, and it was the time of his death and whatnot, and Prince Callan, this noble bearded prince who has to rescue the princess who's been captured by the beast. And in the end, it's a wonderful ending. This big plastic beast figure gets lit on fire and it just crashes into the ground, and that's the end. But I'm surprised you've never heard of Crawl. I mean, it's a pretty mainstream movie, but
I'm starting to feel bad.
Yeah, a lot of people have come up to me and be like, oh man, thank you so much for that Crawl reference. But okay, I've set it up so I can tell you about Crawl Fire Wedding. My friend John was looking through an old comic book once, and on the back he saw an advertisement for the Crawl Wedding, which would consist of the bride would come in on a white horse, just like the, you know, classical princess figure, and the groom would dress up in white with this, you know, he'd have to grow a beard and whatnot. But the most incredible part was this: the best man had to paint an eye on his forehead, Cyclops style. So that just blew me away that you would actually have to send away for a kit. You know, it was like $100. Like, you could have your own crawl wedding. So the idea, like, people are sometimes so great in the things that they come up with, you know, like, what should I sell? Well, I could sell a product, or I could sell food, or I could sell a crawl wedding box, which, I don't know, I imagine just comes with face paint, like, and instructions on how to paint an eye on someone's forehead. So Mel and I, you know, like I said, we got married in, I guess, August 2001. That was really nice.
Did you do it crawl style?
Well, I really wanted to, and Mel loves, she's one of those, like, women that love animals, you know, and that's really great. And I sort of mentioned it as a joke, you know, wouldn't it be funny if we had a crawl wedding, just trying to bug her, you know. And she was all for it.
No.
And my friend Reg, who I was telling you about, who ate the hoagie my play, remember, he passed out on the stage.
Yeah.
He is a huge man, you know, and he would have been the best man, so he would have made a perfect Cyclops. But while I was thinking about this and laughing about this, we live on the bottom of a hill. The hill caught on fire. And it was just the strangest thing, you know, because it was really dry, and our house is old, and there was embers flying down towards our house, and Mel had a bunny at the time, and it was really scary. So it went from high comedy to high terror.
Oh, gosh.
And I guess the song does that too, doesn't it?
It does.
Yeah. So,
indeed.
See, I mean, I can talk about, yeah. I can talk about these things. It takes me a little while, though.
Carrie, when you recreate these songs, or try to, like, make the songs live again for an audience,
mm-hmm.
How do you find that whole process of showing up and playing for people? Do you find it easy to bring the songs alive?
Yeah, I mean, we don't record totally raw, you know, we do overdubs and whatnot. And the way I get around the fact that I'm a little bit uncomfortable that we do that is that there's no way when you record music, there's a deficiency right there, because there's no way that it's going to live up to the live experience. And that for me is like, I mean, we're having this interview and people will write about our music, but it's also so secondary to the actual point where we get up there and we play. I mean, it's just the most incredible thing. And I can totally speak for the rest of the band. Like, it's an experience like no other. I mean, not like no other band. I mean, I guess we turn it up and play, I mean, like every other band, right? But I absolutely love it. I'm not worried too much about how much it sounds like the CD, you know, because the CD has its own sound.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's smart to consider the medium and doctor things so that they suit the specific medium, right?
Right.
Just as, you know, photograph is different from a film, is different from a painting, a live performance is different from the CD. So, I mean, sometimes I don't even sing the same lyrics. Sometimes it just seems appropriate to sing something else, something that's happened this very day, you know?
Were you always a fearless performer? People have given you a lot of props for being so very great at performing.
Oh, well, I'll tell you something. When I was about 3, my mom is just the same, you know. She's just nuts. And I have this recollection of being 3 and seeing her with, you know, when you're young, your parents take you to parties, right? And,
sure.
And there's other kids around, and they, in some way, try and facilitate what the kids want to do, too. So my mom was really, like, the clown for a while, and it was wonderful. And I have this recollection of seeing her coming in a clown outfit at this party, you know. And this is like the 70s, so everyone is totally wasted of the parents on pretty much who knows what, you know. And my mom comes in a full clown outfit and gets up on this chair, and her shtick for a while was she would jump into a teacup. And then that got a little bit old, so she got into this habit of jumping into cakes. So I think, you know, like I'm telling you, the development of the child's brain before, you know, we all know about that. I think that was the point where my brain was really open to suggestions. And
fearlessness runs in the family.
Yeah, in that sense, I'm not afraid of making an idiot of myself because I'm an idiot.
Well, so, I mean, Carrie, you have three records that you've written and recorded now. I mean,
yeah, that's great.
Do you accept that you are a musician now, or I mean, how do you think of yourself now?
I think the moment that you step back and be like, "Self, take a break, buddy. Like, you've really done it." You know, is the moment of death. I really don't want to consider that because it's really wonderful to have a body of work, but I don't want to dwell on that. And there's so many more songs that I want to sing. That's the real love.
But it's music.
It's writing the new music too. Okay. You know, if at some point I think we'll probably stop playing the old songs because we only have so much memory, you know, I mean, so for every new song that gets written, you know, or for every three new songs, one old song is going to have to be deleted, right? So, and that's the way I really like it. I mean, I'm sort of emboldened, I guess, by the way Destroyer works, you know. I mean, Dan Bejar, he doesn't play any of his old songs, and if you don't like
it. Well, he'll say that that's because they were done with a different band, and just too difficult to try to teach someone else the idiosyncrasies of somebody else.
Yeah, he's just being tricky.
Okay.
No, I'm just kidding. I don't know. But I mean, it's sort of sad that I need other people to to make me feel good about this. But yeah.
Carrie, do you think that you would pursue publishing? Written works, more plays, more films? Are these sort of artistic endeavors that you...
Yeah, at some point, definitely. I actually was like, you know, recently I sort of... You know the Japanese author Yukio Mishima?
Uh-huh.
He did an interesting thing in that before he wrote any books, he was like, "I'm going to write this many books, and that's going to be it." And I just think that's a sort of a neat thing to do. So I decided, well, I'm going to write six CDs and record them. And then I'm going to stop. So, and then I'm going to maybe start painting or start writing again full time. So, love me while you can. But who knows? I mean, maybe when do we ever stick to the things that we say? Unless you're Yukio Mishima, but he was a bit crazy too. Yeah. So.
Well, I'll have to make it a point to like check in like 10 years or so and see if your promises to self have been fulfilled.
Find some ditch or alley.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, I'm just kidding. You know why I say that though? It's a funny story. One of the reasons that I made Hobo Camp. Can I tell quick story? It's maybe you won't find it funny, but I sort of do. One of the reasons I wanted to talk about hobos is I recently found out this incredible story. And you know, I've had some times of drinking, you know. So, and I enjoy it. And my dad was like, "You know, you're turning into a bit of a drunk. You should really watch out because," and this is just blew my mind. My grandpa on my mother's side was, you know, just a normal kind of Joe, like I guess in the 50s. And he, you know, he worked a job and he had a car. And one day he came home and he was having his brandy after work, you know, slowly sipping it. And he looked around, you know, the kids are just crawling about, a nice family scene. And he thought to himself, this is absolutely not for me. So he got into his car and he drove down to the car lot and he sold his car and just became, like, at the snap of a finger, a hobo. There wasn't any gradual battle, you know. He just one day was like, this is absolutely not for me. And anytime my mom would ever want to see him, she knew where to where to look. You know?
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe that's funny. Maybe not. But
did you know him?
No.
Okay.
No. There's no way I could have. You know. So
hobos have families.
That's right.
That's almost always.
That's the point of this interview. Hobos have families. Yeah. So.
Well, Carrie, I'd like to thank you very much for coming in and sharing.
Yeah.
And I wish you lots of luck and fun on your tour.
Yeah, sure.
All right.
Thanks so much. It was a really interesting time.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah.
All right.
Bye-bye.
And you're not in the dirt. Where did you run? Did you meet the rich? Laughing out to one to say, you are my garden. So realize I'm found vacation. You're not in the park.
Thank you.